we are chosen for the roles of peacekeeper and soother and possibly entertainer at times, because we temperamentally have been gifted with a certain degree of empathy and sensitivity and psychological mindedness that was not true of our siblings, or if we were only children. So I think that there's a reason why we've been chosen, and it's because of our innate abilities. And those innate abilities, of course, make for a fit with our chosen occupation. So we start out as these empathic, sensitive children who truly do not want to see our family members in pain and have a desire to take that pain away.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Karin Marotta. Dr. Marotta is a psychoanalyst and an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where she has a private practice in Milwaukee. And our focus today is on her recent book called The Analyst's Vulnerability, Impact on Theory and Practice. And what we unpack is her thesis that what we bring to our choice of career and the way we engage with our patients has a great deal to do with our pasts. And she starts us off by describing her own past and how it has contributed to her becoming a psychoanalyst and her orientation as a psychoanalyst. We discuss the role of guilt, of vulnerability, the awkwardness that we feel in acknowledging our gratifications from the work, our intolerance of negative feelings towards patients, our concerns about harming them, and how this all plays a part in the way we understand enactments. I learned a great deal from reading her work and speaking with her. I hope you do the same. She is the author of four books, The Power of Countertransference, Seduction, Surrender, and Transformation, Psychodynamic Techniques, and this most recent, The Analyst Vulnerability. She also sits on the editorial board of Psychoanalytic Psychology and Contemporary Psychoanalysis, and she lectures both nationally and internationally. I hope you enjoy and learn as I did from my conversation with Karin Marotta. Karin, welcome to the podcast. So good to have you here. We recognize in the field that we all bring our histories to this work. We, the practitioners of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, have chosen a field, if not a devotion, to listening to people, trying to understand them, and trying to relieve their stuckness by offering them new options that they hadn't known existed. That says something about us. And many of us have recognized that we share certain characteristics that would lead us to do this kind of work. Sort of a somewhat glib saying that some people bring up, but there's truth to it, that we also have histories in common that lead us to do this kind of work. And the one that's most frequently referred to is the idea that what leads us to want to heal our patients is our own history of wanting to heal our parents. Now, you've taken this thinking further. You have said that not only do you think that's the case, but you think that the theories that we align with are also chosen by us because of their alignment with our developmental history. And those theories include our notions of therapeutic action. And when I asked you to elaborate this, you said, you know, the best way I can do that is by presenting a case. And the case is yourself. So let's begin by your sharing with our listeners your overview sense of the importance of our common characteristics and our developmental histories. And if you will, share something about yourself, and then we will dive into your thinking in greater detail.
All right. Thank you, Harvey. It's nice to be with you today. And in response to your question, I acknowledge that Jacobs, Searles, Olnick, many people have suggested, as you pointed out, that we became therapists in no small part because of our history of healing depressed mothers, sometimes also fathers. I've treated therapists who actually had multiple family members that they were in charge of emotionally, mothers, fathers, sibling. So it can often involve multiple people in the family, but typically, you know, the stereotype is it's the mother, and I think most often the mother is involved. So I think that we are chosen for the roles of peacekeeper and soother and possibly entertainer at times because we temperamentally have been gifted with a certain degree of empathy and sensitivity and psychological mindedness that was not true of our siblings or if we were only children. So I think that there's a reason why we've been chosen, and it's because of our innate abilities. And those innate abilities, of course, make for a fit with our chosen occupation. So we start out as these empathic, sensitive children who truly do not want to see our family members in pain and have a desire to take that pain away. Now, Searles would add in that we naturally do this because children need to restore their mothers so that their mothers can then take care of them. And I certainly don't debate that as well. But so from an early age, we are taught to take too much responsibility for other people's feelings, other people's emotional states, and for attempting to repair and restore them. So I think that, and then that carries over. I don't think we've emphasized that enough and examined it enough in training. I don't think it's examined in personal analysis even, because it's an intergenerational phenomenon that our analysts also had that same role as children. They accept their attitudes and feelings, and they don't question ours. For example, they do not question their own guilt, their own excessive sense of responsibility, their own excessive self-sacrifice at times.
Now, you just went from describing our analysts having a blind spot that gets in the way of their analyzing our blind spot, if you will, and then you elaborated having to do with guilt and self-sacrifice. Now, we're going to get to those and unpack them. But what you mean is that there are certain things that aren't dealt with in our treatment, you feel, that leads us to not be aware of certain inclinations we have that lead us to this work.
Correct. I think that we come to our own treatments with our feelings of guilt, fear of doing harm, passivity, self-sacrifice, and those come out in our analysis. But because our analysts share the same history, they are often blind to discussing those more fully and talking about how they contribute to our not only our vocational choice, but our ways of being in the world.
But that would be a very individual thing. Different analysts would be differentially aware of such motivations.
True.
Yeah?
Yes, yeah, of course. Okay. Sure.
Right, sure.
It's a generalization.
Yeah, I hear you. And you have your story, which you speak of in the book, and I think it's helpful to start our conversation off with your own story.
Yeah, I said in the book, and it's true, that I don't generally reveal a lot about my background, as most of us do not, but I thought, if I'm going to advocate for incorporating our early experiences, that I should at least devote some time to describing my own. And I'm going to actually read this from the book because it's just personally easier for me. So I say in the book, early on page 7, in the interest of transparency, I will disclose some of my own motivations for becoming an analyst. My mother came to the United States from Australia, having married my father there during World War II. To put it mildly, she never adjusted to being there. My father's parents came over from Hungary and spoke little English. His sisters did not care for my mother and resented her for coming from a significantly higher socioeconomic class. They thought her haughty with her highbrow British-sounding accent. When people called the house, they thought we had a maid. My mother became wearily accustomed to jokes about kangaroos and questions about whether or not her family was descended from criminals. My mother was naturally quite playful and charming. She loved music and laughed easily. She was warm and nurturing. I loved her deeply. But she was also incredibly sad and lonely. My father was a workaholic, and she depended on her 3 children for company. My older sister resented her neediness. My twin brother felt overwhelmed by it. I anguished over her pain and worked daily to take it away. When she was terribly upset with us for misbehaving, she would emptily threaten to go back to Australia, then apologize later for speaking out of frustration and anger. Looking back, I think I took on the job of making sure she didn't ever really want to leave. My story is not just about fear of loss and excessive responsibility for my mother's feelings. It is also implicitly a story of ambivalence. As much as I loved my mother, I also hated her passivity, her seeming unwillingness to make a genuine effort to assimilate and build a life for herself, and her expectations that I would be a consistent, soothing presence. As I write this, I'm aware of my own warnings about the possible idiosyncratic nature of theory building. Nonetheless, I think it is reasonable to suggest that to the extent that therapists were their mother's keepers, they also would share this ambivalence. During my childhood, I was not aware of these feelings, of course, but I did become aware of them in adolescence, especially in the face of my older sister's rage at my mother. This is only a keyhole into my childhood experiences, and I have observed myself confronting many aspects of my relationships in my family, including with my siblings, in the course of doing treatment. I will also add that my early interest in countertransference came both from my own intense feelings toward my patients, and of course the desire to rescue them, and also from experiencing my analyst's intense countertransference to me. My first book, The Power of Countertransference, is in part my account of that struggle.
Thank you for sharing that. Just to let the listeners know, you read from your recent book, The Analyst's Vulnerability, Impact on Theory and Practice. And thank you for sharing that. I think it's fair to say that we all could tell such a story. The factors in our childhood that has led us to do this work, though we often don't, and we certainly don't often put it in print. And I thank you for your clarity. One of the points you make, and you make it in your relationship with your mother, and you make it in the book about our work, is the issue of self-sacrifice. And let me read just a few sentences from your section on self-sacrifice. You write, "The therapeutic relationship provides ample room for both healthy self-sacrifice and healthy, mutually beneficial gratification. Unhealthy sacrifice and gratification also exist, of course. Sacrifice sometimes leads to deep resentment and an uncomfortable sense of having submitted to a sadistic patient, while at other times it brings the tranquil satisfaction of having relinquished pride and power in the interests of another. So beautifully put. You then go on to say, how are we to discern when our needs are being met in the interest of the patient or at his or her expense? And when does healthy self-sacrifice devolve into masochistic submission? Tell us about healthy self-sacrifice and masochistic submission.
Well, again, I think it comes from the many decades now that I've been doing this work. And I like to observe myself and my reactions and have from very early in my career, you know, as a keyhole into what's happening between my patient and myself. And I certainly have noticed over time with many patients and very early on that when I sacrifice too much, you know, when I was too flexible, even with simple things like appointment changes, fee reductions, and even more so with tolerance for criticism, for even abuse, that giving into the patient, just being a silent listener and maintaining some type of holding environment was very costly to me. That I noticed over time, to after too many sessions like this, or too many sacrifices, I would go home at night and feel depressed and not happy about the work. And I thought to myself, and since I'm a firm believer in mutuality, I decided to myself, if I am this unhappy after dealing with difficult people and giving away the store, can it really be good for them?
Giving away the store. Tell me what you mean by that.
Giving away more than I would say giving away more than I wanted to. It seems like a very simple, almost crude way of assessing it. But the truth is, you can only give what you can with some joy, right, and true sense of meaning. That's where I think when you start to give because the patient has demanded it, when you start to give because you feel guilty if you don't, and you really don't want to, that the result inevitably is resentment.
And when you say give, you're meaning take their harsh criticisms? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, make concessions, accommodate changes, accommodate fees.
Okay.
Allow extensive criticism and even verbal abuse. Yes.
That's such a tricky call.
It is.
Because there are times, I know you appreciate that because it's clear in your writing that you do, but just to lay it out, there are times where it is vital to receive the explosiveness of a patient and to literally receive it and do something with it other than they anticipate and other that they felt when they received it as a child, because I think that's often what gets replayed. So there is something to sitting it and metabolizing it. And then, as you say, there's a point where that is not constructive, where saying, you know, this is enough, is therapeutically useful. Do you have any guidelines for when you lean one way or the other?
I do. I think I certainly agree with you, but I would also add that most therapists are too good at this, too good at tolerating, metabolizing, allowing. And as valuable as I think that is, I think I agree with Hirsch that often goes on too long. That I think we definitely, it's part of providing that initial base relationship and sense of safety, that the patient can feel free to be critical, can feel free to, you know, even throw obscenities at us now and then, or be very critical and be very challenging, make demands, and not be rebuked for that. I think that's certainly an essential element of building the trust and the safety early on in treatment. The problem is not doing that. It's that it goes on too long. Why does it go on too long? It goes on too long because we had no power as children to confront our parents to say, this is enough. And we carry that into our roles as adult therapists. And we are very reluctant to confront our patients and say, you know what, I am tired of being criticized. Clearly you're angry with me. Perhaps we could find a more constructive way together for you to express that anger other than, you know, litanies of my shortcomings.
Mm-hmm. That's often especially when it goes on too long, it's a defensive gesture on the patient's part that they're so terrified of their dependence upon you. They feel so vulnerable when they recognize how important you are to them that their only way of coping is to attack, to announce some separation. At least they feel so open to what's scary for them, which is how much they need you.
I think that's a great point, Harvey, and that's the essence of why it's not therapeutic to participate in that by being passively receptive, because the patient isn't getting any better. You're really colluding with the patient's defenses, as you so just beautifully put, and that's why it's not therapeutic.
This leads us into another topic that you write about at length, which is the importance of analysts recognizing their wish for gratification. Now, as soon as one says this, of course, you have to add caveats right away. Like, well, we don't mean this kind of gratification, and we don't mean that kind of gratification. It's a sin or something. Like, analysts aren't supposed to have gratification aside from the bill being paid. Let me read what you wrote about that. The notion of any ongoing gratification for the analyst as an inherent part of a successful treatment, especially the notion that the patient helps the analyst to change or provides emotional or intellectual sustenance for the analyst, remains foreign. Although I use the term gratification throughout, I'm referring not merely to immediate pleasure, relief, or satisfaction, and now this is in italics, I'm referring primarily to a deeper experience of shared deep emotion, personal growth, fulfillment, and transformation for the analyst as a requisite consequence of the analytic process. That's quite a statement. Can you flesh that out for us?
Well, it's not easily done in a few minutes, of course. But
I understand. Sure.
Yeah. All right. I mean, I think we can all relate to feeling frustrated and thwarted and defeated in treatment. But I think we can all relate also to feeling on a fairly regular basis very deeply moved and gratified by the exchanges that we have with our patients. And I think, you know, the therapeutic action for me, an essential aspect of the therapeutic action, is emotional surrender. So in those quiet moments where we both feel deep affect, deep feelings, there's almost always some mutual transformation that takes place. And it's again, as you said, we always insert these caveats. Oh, no, it's not unseemly. It's not something terrible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And again, why do we assume that that's true? I don't think we would question that in any other relationships that there's a degree of mutual gratification, even other professional relationships.
Yeah, probably because the possibility, if not temptation, of exploiting the patient for one's own other gratifications is ever present. And
it
that
is.
May be why we quickly say, no, I don't mean that.
Yes. And I think too, if I were to be more candid about it, I didn't say this in the book, I think that if one is not expecting to be gratified and is moved by a particular patient in a way, I think especially for early career therapists, mm-hmm. analysts,
yeah.
it can be easy to start kind of falling into wanting other gratifications from that patient, to start seeing that patient, as Searles would say, as actually the person who is going to heal and rescue us. And Solenza has recently emphasized that in her work as well. And once we fall into wanting the patient to rescue us and transform us, then we're in trouble. But I think we can't throw the gratification baby out with the bathwater, because those deeply moving transformative moments exist and do not have to be exploited. And I think most of the time, quite frankly, they're not exploited.
But not as you point out, not as easily spoken of.
Correct. I think one of the big problems we have that really gets in the way of training new analysts and therapists in the analytic method and being more collegial and cooperative with ourselves in creating new theory and techniques is all of the subjects that do not get explored. And Jacobs talks about this, and Banagy, other people, that we have no innovations in technique. We're just not moving forward with with the whole analytic and endeavor in a way that I think we could. And it's so much of it is because so many real topics like, you know, limiting self-sacrifice, our tendency toward masochism, the fact that we are gratified and transformed by our patients. If we keep shoving those topics off to the margins or ignoring them, we can't move forward.
Let me invite you to jump into the fray. You have some comments in your book about Beyond's statement. And Beyond is very popular in certain areas of the analytic world and in the States. And you have some clear thoughts about it. Why don't you go on record?
All right, fine. I'll do that. I believe I did.
You did in the book. Yes, you did. Sure you did.
And what I said in the book is that I think that as poetic and beautiful and moving as the notion of, you know, reverie and without memory or desire may be, that I said even not only is it impossible, but I think aspirationally even it's problematic, because I think that we all do have moments of reverie. We have moments where we transcend ourselves in our thoughts and emotional experiences of our patients. But to expect that as the norm, I think, which some people do, is again putting up this notion of the analytic persona as perfection. That we could actually come into our work day to day, hour to hour with our patients without our own needs, without our own desires, without our own expectations is not realistic and not a reasonable goal. To me, I would agree with Wilson, who's a more reasonable goal is to try to be aware of those desires, those needs at any moment in time with any patient, and try and incorporate that or account for that in the treatment process. That would lead to a more positive therapeutic result than denying our needs and our feelings and our gratification we might need in that moment to try and aspire to no memories, no desires. That's just not human nature.
I hear you. It won't surprise anyone listening to this conversation that you have thoughts about the role of conflict. And conflict, of course, in our field lives in two spaces. There's intrapsychic conflict and there's interpersonal conflict. And each often reflects the other. Tell us your understanding of conflict and what place you think it should have in the therapeutic action model that we keep in mind when we're working?
Well, I think that it's interesting. I wish some of the people who began and were so integral to the two-person movement were still with us, like especially Steve Mitchell, of course, and Lou Aaron, but also Jeremy Safran, who of course popularized the whole notion of rupture and repair, you know, building on Tronick's work and other people, and the idea that we can't have these ongoing ruptures with our patients because the relationship falls apart. And his research, you know, showed that. But the work of Safran that's ignored is that he said that conflict was essential. And that he was quoted as saying that he despaired sometimes of the way that his work was applied. And what I mean by that is that we rush in when our patients are unhappy with us, when they criticize us, when they're angry with us. I think we often adapt, again, this passive attitude where we will take, and I think it's a misapplication of the notion of our own fallibility. Even if we did something, which often we do, to affront, you know, the patient. Mm-hmm. Whether it be small or significant, or even if we can't identify it, I think that we feel almost ethically obligated to endorse the patient's position, even apologize whether we felt that we did anything or not. And that immediately squelches the conflict. And I think that's all a part of this whole good mother persona, this desired, I think, well-intentioned desire to acknowledge the patient's reality, it's our desire to admit to our participation sometimes run amok. And it's squelched.
And when you're referring to conflict, you mean the interpersonal conflict where you said X and the patient says they are hurt by your saying X or they're misunderstood by your saying X and you should apologize and say what they wanted you to say, which is Y.
Which is
something other than you said. In other words, that they feel you've done something wrong, you've said something wrong, and rather than exploring how they heard you, what it felt like to them, what they imagine you meant, what their understanding of themselves and you and the relationship is as a result of your having said that, all the exploration of meaning, you say people skip over and just say, oh, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I wouldn't agree with that. I think that's too simplistic. I think most people attempt to explore it in some form. Particularly aggressive patients, often aren't interested in that. Will demand an apology or continue to berate. And I think under those circumstances, too often the response is to masochistically submit to the patient's desire for.
That's what I was meaning. Yes.
Yes.
And rather than that, you sort of are suggesting to maintain the tension.
Correct.
To say that that's how they see it and that's how you see it and we can live with that and come to understand it.
Yes. And sometimes, too, the exploration is very beneficial to me because I may not understand the criticism at all. But as we explore it further and I see the emotional impact and understand it better, it puts me in a better spot as an analyst to be emotionally authentic in acknowledging my part. Because the patient also helps me to see my part.
Absolutely. Sure. But you also relate that to models of treatment having to do with mother and infancy. Let me read what you write about that. The intense emphasis on the mother-child relationship as one to be relived in treatment has resulted in interventions aimed at reducing conflict in favor of empathic attunement. However, the need for the mother and child to be as in sync as often as possible to facilitate the infant's early development is not a perfect model for analytic treatment. It is our dark sides, regardless of the source, that we struggle to accept and need to make peace with in treatment. So you're proposing not basing the treatment relationship on the mother-infant relationship, which for some is obvious and for others is outrageous.
Well, that's what's interesting about our field, Harvey. It's just, yeah. Right. So many people would say, well, of course, you know, just doing the mother-infant thing, that's ridiculous. And other people would say, well, that's the most important thing. That's our role. Mm-hmm. That's the therapeutic action, is that we are the good mothers. But as I point out in the book, that's historically been true from the beginning. If you look at Strachey's definition of therapeutic action. If you look at Rowald's, up to the present, there's a history of the therapeutic action being based on introjection of the analyst as a person. And the underlying assumption, which I like to challenge, is that we are in fact better people, better parents than and more generous than other people, including the patient's parents. And I would take issue with that. I think that's an arrogant, often inaccurate assumption. I think that all parents make mistakes, and we might be able to not recreate that mistake with a given patient to their benefit. But the idea that the chief way that we help our patients is by being a better parent is something I take great issue with.
Let me spend a moment on that, because while what I agree with what you're saying, we're not parents and we're not either better or worse parents, but we are their therapists and analysts. And for example, going back to the metabolizing notion, when a patient is angry at us or is critical of us, and we receive it and we may feel a pinch, but in addition to that, we also are trying to understand where it comes from in them, what they might be meaning in addition to what they're saying, why it arises now, et cetera, et cetera. We are offering them a model of self-awareness that they don't get anywhere else. And that's not being a better parent. That's being more self-aware. And that is, it seems to me, one of the gifts of what we offer patients.
I totally agree. But to me, that's not an essential parenting function so much as it is, it's a professional skill that we bring.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That I consider that part of the professional skill and knowledge that we bring to bear in the therapeutic process that is unique and is therapeutic, is that safe space for exploration and understanding and dialogue that I think few people actually have with anyone, and probably didn't have with their parents, you know. So I'm not saying that we don't offer any functions. It's more of how we conceive ourselves. And then again, that goes back to early experiences and how that translates into the way that we actually implement the ideas of holding, safety, interpretation. But no, I would agree, because the goal is self-understanding and acceptance. And so that type of openness to exploration is essential. But again, back to what you said earlier, if that's what's really going on and the space is opening up and more exploration and deeper exploration is taking place, I think I would wager that you couldn't find anyone who would disagree that that's essentially therapeutic. But in the instance that you mentioned, if the patient is really using that as a defense and comes in and even keeps upping the ante, waiting to get a response of anger, or a limit setting, wanting and needing it, and we ignore that and participate in the defense, then that is not therapeutic.
And what is that patients take in how we listen to them and learn to listen to themselves in that way, and also listen to others in that way.
Mm-hmm.
That self-awareness can be contagious.
I think this might be a good time for me to give this example of the first case that I experimented with expressing my negative countertransference and how I broke an enactment through that process.
But why don't we set it up by talking about enactment, because that's one of the important contributions that your book makes and that I learned and hadn't considered in quite this way before. And I really recommend the book, if for nothing else, just your work on enactment. Your point is that enactments, while obviously inevitable, aren't necessarily virtuous, as the field is sort of making it out to be now. It is useful to understand them and unpack them and survive them for sure, and use them to understand oneself and one's patient, absolutely. But you add a new perspective on it, and that is, let me read what you say, and then we'll talk about the case. Your point is that the analyst is having negative countertransference feelings that he or she may be aware of, may not be, but that is the foreplay, if you will, to the enactment. And you write, if one accepts the premises presented here, that negative feelings toward the patient were in awareness prior to enactment, that these feelings lead to a gradual emotional disengagement, and that the enactment is the natural unconscious attempt by both analyst and patient to re-engage, then it becomes plausible to focus on the analyst's negative feelings towards the patient with an eye toward the analyst intervening deliberately to minimize enactments. That said, why don't you tell us about your case?
Okay, all right. This was very early on in my career, and I was treating a very difficult patient, very verbally abusive to her husband, and tried not to be to her young daughter, which is what motivated her to come to treatment, which I was, very sympathetic to. She didn't want to be an abusive parent, but she was often physically and emotionally out of control. I saw her twice a week at a reduced fee, and she had a very traumatic, sexually abused, physically abused, childhood, and she would become very agitated and angry with me. She felt her progress was inadequate, as many very damaged people do, and became convinced that if I only loved her more, she would get better. And every few weeks, she would have kind of this emotional storm. She would come in And she would say, if only you would love me, if only, you know, you could do this for me, if only you could hold me, if only I would be healed. And then would proceed to criticize me terribly and tell me what a terrible person I was, that I wasn't a good therapist, I wasn't helping her. And I began to, and I think there isn't a therapist in the world who can't relate to this, I began to dread seeing her. And especially after a couple of weeks would go by where we didn't have this enactment occurring, I thought, I knew it was coming. And when I knew, I thought, oh my God, it's almost time now. And I would think, oh, is it going to be today? And that's a terrible position, I think, for a therapist to be in. Dreading the patient, afraid of the patient, really. And afraid of our own rage toward the patient. How will I manage? What will I do? Because I hate this person when they come in and do this. And we don't talk about that at all. Mm. And except people bring that to me because of my writing, but very, you know, in private, one-on-one or seeking consultation. I just hate this person. No. So I went for consultation. You know, I was new and young. I consulted with several people. I talked to, you know, therapist friends. I kept trying to work it out. And everyone, of course, had a different opinion about what I should do. But they were all along the conventional lines of, you know, be more empathic. Have you tried telling her, of course, you understand that she wishes she could have what she didn't get as a child, that you're sympathetic to her plight, to her intense feelings of deprivation. I did all that many times. And it would sometimes placate her for a little while because she felt that at least I understood her. But and this is the key thing for enactment. It never stopped that scenario from repeating. And as that scenario kept repeating, I became more hostile and distant from her. And I was very aware of my negative feelings. So finally, I just started thinking to myself, all the advice in the world, experienced analysts have told me what to do, what to interpret, what empathy to provide. It's not working. So what do I think about what I need to do? And what is the impact on the patient? What am I really feeling when she is demanding love? And I discovered, of course, very easily that I didn't feel love for her, even though I did care about her. In those moments, I hated her. And that somehow the key to breaking free of this enactment was to tell her. And so she came in one day and she's berating me. And I just said, you know what? You don't love me. I do not feel loved. And I don't love you. I feel that you got me by the throat up against the wall. I feel terrible. I don't want to be in the room with you. I feel angry, frustrated, and I even hate you sometimes. And I just don't see that this is not good. And other than some anxiety that she expressed out of fear that I was going to terminate her, which I quickly assured her I was not, her response just amazed me. I thought she'd be upset, she'd cry, something. She became extremely calm, and this was a very agitated patient. She became extremely calm and still, and I thought, what's going on? And then she turns to me and says, we've been through this so many times. Why didn't you just say this before? And I was just completely taken aback, startled. And I said, so you needed me to say this? And she said, yes. And I said, well, why? She said, because you're right. I want you to love me, but I hate you knowing that you can't love me. And what I really am expressing is hate toward you. She wasn't this articulate, but she's a very intelligent woman and came very close to this and said, but if I expressed any anger at my mother, she would slap me across the face, knock me around the room. She said, I thought, I do get angry. I do have all this aggression. I do feel it toward you. But I thought if I ever said it, you would not care for me and you would terminate me and our relationship would be over. And she became much calmer, and we never repeated that intense scenario again. And much to my amazement, and she began calming down in her relationship with her husband. coming, expressing her anger more freely and talking about her anger and frustration in the world. And that just was world-changing for me. It just completely turned around my whole idea of how to do treatment.
I have this urge to jump in and recommend to our listeners that they don't try this at home. This is done by an expert on a race course that was closed. And please don't tomorrow tell your patients that you hate them, right?
Actually, I would give that advice. I often tell people, if you're going to experiment with self-disclosure, and the trickiest, although the most effective, is usually disclosure of negative feelings, you do some consultation. Think about it, which I did, by the way. I thought about this at great length and was prepared to say these things. I did not say them impulsively. I did not shoot from the hip.
And that's what's key. That's what's key.
That's what's key.
You thought about it. And you thought about her well-being while doing it. That's what's key.
And I knew it was essential that I be in control, that I show emotion, but be in control so that I would be effective but not frighten her or disturb the safety of the environment. So yes, I gave it a great deal of thought. It was not an impulsive move. But let me talk to your point about awareness. If you look at the case write-ups, and I defy you to find one that doesn't have this embedded in it, is that while the therapist may, and I believe is, unaware of their negative countertransference at the moment of enactment, if you read their very own case reports, they will talk about this estrangement, these negative feelings, this anger, this hopelessness, this depression they were feeling with the patient prior to the enactment, just as I felt anger, frustration, you know, thwarted with my patient who I expressed my anger and hatred toward. And so and that's when I began to realize, well, what is the function of enactment then? What's really happening? If you look at these case reports, the therapist is going into the patient's world. The patient is dominant and changing the therapist as opposed to what we would desire.
You laugh as you say it, yeah?
Yeah, well, it's true because it's like, well, I agree that with people say there's this constant attempt to influence and change each other. And I say, you know, you're in trouble when the patient's always winning. You know, if the patient is, if you're feeling depressed, anxious, thwarted, unable to express yourself, it's not going as desired. And I don't think anyone would dispute that. So I'm saying we all fall into these states, it's inevitable. But that what I say is enactment isn't necessarily inevitable. I mean, it is on occasion, but not with the frequency with which it occurs. And I think it occurs so frequently because there's such a taboo on us expressing our negative feelings. So
even to ourselves, even to be self-aware, you're saying.
Yes. And Mills talks about that people won't even do it at conferences because they feel too much guilt and shame about their anger or their Schadenfreude, you know, at their or competitiveness with their patients. So they can't even admit it to themselves. They stuff it down, and then enactment becomes inevitable from that point on because people become disengaged and desperately need this emotional storm, this forced conflict, which often is quite negative and out of control, so that emotional re-engagement can take place. So my point is, why follow this disastrous path, often over weeks or months, using up valuable therapy time, when a pattern has been discerned and things aren't shifting, aren't changing? Think about what needs to happen and what type of disclosure, probably of negative feelings, needs to take place. And how can that be done in a constructive way to re-engage?
Let me clarify. Are you saying that being self-aware of the negative feelings is essential to minimize the likelihood of enactment, or are you saying disclosing those negative feelings?
No, I'm saying self-awareness.
Self-awareness. Got it. Yeah. That's my thought. Right. Right.
You can't deliberately disclose without self-awareness, obviously.
Right. There are so many points in this book that can lead to further discussion. This one on enactment, for me, is the one that has stayed with me. It was so fresh. It was so new and not spoken about that I think you've introduced a new paradigm to our literature, which is instead of extolling the virtues of enactment, think about what preceded it in the analyst. And that might shorten, if not eliminate, the need for enactments and lead to greater insight. And also you're implying, tell me if I have this right, address the self-sacrifice / masochism that may be going on in the analyst as well. Yes?
Yes. I think part of our extreme tolerance for negative feelings is because, you know, we were forced into a passive position as children because we, for obvious reasons, we couldn't confront our parents. We couldn't tell them, mm-hmm. hey, knock it off. You know, we couldn't say, hey, I'm really angry. We were scared. We were trying to restore them. We were being soothing. And that passivity, that unnecessary degree of passivity and the desire to have good feelings toward our patients, I think often can lead us down a bad road.
Yeah. We sort of end where we began by self-awareness, both of our present internal life and our developmental life. Karen, thank you so much for your contributions, which I'm sure are ongoing. I'm sure you have other projects coming up.
I do.
Perhaps we'll get together when they get published as well. Thanks so much for spending time with us and sharing.
Well, thank you for a great interview, Harvey. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.